Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then, add the final touch with 2 for $8 on select 2.5 or 3-quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.
Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
And Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
If I ever have any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research, man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Hello, folks, and welcome into this week's edition of Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and I really appreciate you all being here and making this show a part of your weekly golf content. My four guests this week are just going to knock your socks off. The first one is a Golf Magazine Top 100 teacher who provides more free content out there on social media than just about anybody. Another one is a tour legend who had one of the sweetest swings of all time. Another is going to help build your confidence when you're out there playing. And we'll round it out with a head professional at an iconic golf course up in my hometown of Pittsburgh. So who am I talking about? Well, my first guest is going to be Jonathan Yarwood. He has worked with major champions like 2005 U.S. Open champ Michael Campbell. We'll talk about how underrated Michael was as a player. He also spent some time with Nelly Korda when she was a young player. Jonathan and I will also talk about the rash of people out there giving swing tips. Please be sure you are following somebody who is qualified to be giving swing lessons and not somebody who's out there wrecking your golf swing. Be careful who you follow and who you listen to. Check out their background first. We'll talk about that when Jonathan joins me. Following him, I'll get a return visit from Tom Percher. That's the guy who's got one of the sweetest swings of all time. He had success playing out on tour over the course of four decades, winning in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. I'll get his thoughts on the tour championship, on whether the professional game would be in its current splintered state if Dean Beaman was still the commissioner. We'll also look back at the two-person teams that he got to be a part of back when they did those kind of things late in the year after the tour schedule was over. Looking forward to having Tom back as part of the show. He'll round out part one. Then in part two, we'll get our monthly visit from the confidence doctor, Dr. Bob Winters. He recently went on a trip up to Alaska and learned some lessons in patience and persistence while he was there. He'll share all of that with us. And then we'll round out this week's show with the head professional at the Pittsburgh Field Club, Chris Sheehan. Chris has been a wonderful friend of this show for many years. Pittsburgh golf is way underrated out there in the golf world. You guys know about Oakmont, which is a few miles outside the city. They're preparing for the U.S. Open, which comes back there next year. But there's also Fox Chapel, which just hosted the U.S. Women's Senior Open a couple of weeks ago. Pittsburgh Field Club is right next door to them. Allegheny Country Club is another historic course up there that's not far away either. Plus, they've got several other great golf courses that you can play in the area. Chris is going to weigh in on them, plus a whole lot more when he joins me. So, folks, as always, a lot of great stuff lined up for you this week here on Next on the Tee, and I thank you so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me. Okay, before we get started, I want to give a shout-out to our friends over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. TribLive.com is the leading news website for Western Pennsylvania with news around the clock. Pittsburgh pro sports coverage, a high school sports network, a podcast network, which you can find Next on the Tee on. So go out and bookmark TribLive.com or download the Trib Live app for free and stay up to date with all the news in Western Pennsylvania and this show. I also want to talk about our friends over at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company and Iron City Beer, a brand that I have loved my whole life and started drinking when I was 21 years old, of course. Whether you're a hacker or a scratcher, The secret to a successful day on the links is knowing when it's time to grab an iron, even if that means keeping it in the bag till the 19th hole. If it's been a while since you've reached for Pittsburgh staple beer, it's time to revisit Iron City. Thanks to their incredible new facility in Creighton, the best tasting Iron City beer ever made is now available at a course near you. Iron City pairs well with any lye and sky and serves as a friendly reminder that there's always next round. Iron City beer, best enjoyed while enjoying life. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddy's trip locations. When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You gotta see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade. From the very beginning, P790 irons have been rooted in clean aesthetics and thoughtful design. However, their true beauty is found beneath the surface. With AI-optimized weighting and speed foam air on the inside, every iron is uniquely designed to perform exactly how you need it to. As striking as they are on the outside, their true beauty lies within. Learn more about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade by checking out their website at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Okay, now back with me here on Next on the Tee is top 100 instructor Jonathan Yarwood. Let me remind you a little bit about Jonathan's background. He spent 10 years as an elite golf coach at the David Ledbetter Golf Academy, followed by a year as the director of instruction at the Ritz-Carlton in Sarasota, Florida. He then became the director of instruction at the Concession Golf Club, designed by our friend Tony Jacklin and Jack Nicklaus. He was then recruited to head up the new golf initiative at Loughborough University to create a state-of-the-art biomechanics service. He coached Michael Campbell to the 2005 U.S. Open Championship. He founded his own golf academy in 2007. He is now the director of instruction at Alpine Country Club in New Jersey, working alongside my dear friend slash cousin John Mascari. Jonathan has also coached 2 U.S. amateur winners, 2 U.S. girls winners, 3 AJGA players of the year, plus winners on the PGA, LPGA, European, Challenge, Asian, and Australia Asian tours, as well as several other amateur victories and ranked players. And I'm very excited I get to have him back with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Jonathan, thanks for coming back on the show.
Hey, Chris, thanks very much. It's when you read all that out, geez, it makes me seem very old. That's a long career you've surmised there, I can assure you.
Well, you certainly aren't old, but you definitely are accomplished. And I understand you're actually down in Orlando right now doing more great things, helping out our junior golfers.
Yeah, I'm down at the International Junior Golf Academy down in Orlando. I'm one of their technical consultants. So I come down here. There's 100 kids from all around the world who are aspiring to be pros or get to college through golf. And they run a great program down here. They've got a great team of coaches, great facility. And I'm their technical consultant. So I come down and we've got a Swing Catalyst dual force plate studio in here. We've got a TrackMan. We've got video and stuff. So, you know, I come down and I'm like the consultant, the sounding board. We create a blueprint for each player based on facts and evidence. So we get them in, we test them physically, we test them in every way, a week of testing actually. And then from that, we then create a blueprint and a roadmap for each individual. So we're just implementing it at the moment. So it's a very busy period. So I'm glad I've got a few minutes to talk to you. I've been talking about golf since 7:30 this morning, and it's now almost 7:30 at night. So let's talk a bit more golf.
And Jonathan, you do more for our game by the way of free tips daily on social media than probably anybody out there, when you could probably keep those to yourselves, charge hundreds of dollars for people to come and get those from you. Talk about why you do it.
That's interesting, really. I mean, at a stage of my career, as you said, you listed some of the things I've done and been very fortunate to do actually in my career. I mean, I've coached Nelly Korda, I've coached Michael Campbell, I've coached a whole race of Raptor players, really. I've been very fortunate, very privileged to be involved and create, you know, a lot of improvements and changes and a good record in the amateur game as well as the professional game. So, I'm at a stage of my career, I'm on the back nine of my career, I'm getting older now, and I just want to give back. And I give back through social media a little bit. It's quite interesting, really, because I get coaches sending me messages and stuff who I've never ever heard of, I've never met or anything like that, but saying, oh, you've had a big influence in my career, you've really helped me. I base a lot of what I do on what I see you do and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I think that's a good way to give back. You know, I started out, with nothing and no one, and got help from David Ledbetter, got help from, you know, lots of other people, also worked extremely hard, got exposed to some great people. And in those days before social media, you know, as you say, you kept it to yourself. It was like a little hidden secret. So there was very few of us. Nowadays we can spread the message and spread the it's not so much secrets, but we can spread some stuff that I've done that works and has proven to work over a period of time with various players. And it's quite reward. It's quite satisfying actually to give it back. I'm not a big ego guy. It's only teaching golf is all we do. So if I can help coaches, which I do, either in person or surreptitiously through the internet, I'm happy to do that, and obviously help players and amateur players as well. And I run a little online golf service on the back of it as well, which is extremely popular. I'm just happy to help people. I think there's so much information on golf online, and social media in particular, probably more than any other sport if you look at it. And I spend my time trying to sift through a little bit, trying to dispel some of the myths and some of the BS out there. There is a lot of BS in actual fact, and I get a huge amount of players coming to me, amateur players at my club in Alpine, New Jersey, who are really confused. You know, they've listened to this person, that person. They just got an amalgamation of ideas that doesn't fit together, or they've overconsumed elite player content that's not based or aimed towards them. So part of my social stuff and part of my giving back is to try and simplify it, try and say, hey, you know, I've seen this and it doesn't work for most players, but it might work for 1%. Here's what you want to do instead. And I just try and give an honest account and sift through and help people get better through the game. So help coaches and players there. There's no massive reward for it other than giving back a little bit. I'm quite satisfied and enjoy doing it.
You mentioned there's so much BS out there. And that is one of the things that is hard for amateurs like me to kind of, as you mentioned, sift through to find out what's good and what's bad. Talk about that, because as I look out on whether it's YouTube or social media, there's a lot of people out there giving advice. It's hard to understand which ones are qualified to do so.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of what I call self-appointed gurus out there who basically are just plagiarizing information from other people. They've never actually been in the field. They've never actually been in the trenches. They've never actually tried it and had long-term relationships with players to see if it works. They've just literally just stolen a few ideas and they pass themselves off as experts. So, and in the world of social media, you can do that. You can expose yourself as an expert very easily, even though you might not have much credibility. I think Tiger Woods said a great thing the other day when he said the best thing you do for your golf game is to not look at YouTube. Because, you know, you can look at so many things. And I say a lot of it's got merit, there's no doubt, but there's a lot of contrived stuff out there. You know, it drives me nuts, some of the contrived stuff, you know, where the lead wrist is in flexion and the face is dead closed, and you try and copy DJ or Brooks or some. I mean, they're all outliers. They are absolute outlier, supreme athletes. Unless you can do 9 matchups of DJ swing, the worst thing you do is flex your wrist and close the face. You're going to destroy 99% of people. So I spend a bit of time trying to be the voice of reason a little bit with things like that. But if you use it wisely, you know, the social media can be great and the content can be great, but you have to use it wisely. So how do you use it wisely? What I advise people to do and what I do with clients of mine and people I work with is, okay, if you're going to consume content on what is pertinent to you. Okay, how do you do that? Well, you've got to figure out where you are on the map. So there's 2 ways you can do that. Number one, you've got the most powerful training aid on earth in your pocket. You can film your swing. Film your swing and see what stands out. You know, is it coming over the top? Okay, it's coming over the top. Well, go and consume a load of stuff on how to stop coming over the top. That's going to help you. Second thing you can do is go and see your local PGA pro or a coach in your area who can help you in person. Then consume stuff on what he's told you to do. Try and find a fact and evidence-based coach. Third thing you do, which is, again, is very popular, and I do tons of it, is online stuff. Film your swing, send it to someone like me, or send it to someone who does online lessons who's got some credibility, not a self-appointed guy, someone who has some credibility and results, and then get a personal lesson online like that. You can go through the Skillless app, you can go through my site, and then from there, then you've got at least a starting point to consume something that's pertinent to you. You know, the worst thing you can do is just consume. I get so many people in my studio in person who go, geez, man, I've got 47 swing thoughts at the moment. You know, George Gankas has said this. Chris Como said that. Jonathan Yarwood said this. This guy said that. I don't know where to turn. So when I get people like that, I say, right, if you're a computer, we're going to take the plug out. We're going to reboot you, put the plug back in, put some new software in, and then you're going to have all the malware out of the way, and we're going to move in a good, solid direction. So that's how you can kind of foil against it and use it as a very powerful and good thing, which it can be, but it could also be extremely divisive and destructive if you overconsume and consume stuff that is no relevance to you whatsoever. So best case, just film it on your phone. Get your mate to film it. Just film me down the line, face on. Oh, my goodness. You know, my head's moving miles ahead of my driver. Okay, I know for a fact if my head moves ahead of my driver, the attack angle is going to go down. I don't want to do that. Okay, let me go and consume some content on hip sway versus head sway with the driver. Let me look at Sportbox AI. Okay, great. Okay, got it. Then you're going to improve. And it kind of works like that.
Jonathan, you talk about so many of us have so many swing thoughts once we get out to the golf course, where our hands are, where our hips are, et cetera, et cetera. We end up playing golf swing versus playing golf.
Yeah.
What do you recommend to your students for how many swing thoughts you should have as you're getting out and teeing it up on the first tee?
Well, I never, in person and in any lessons I give, I never give above one thought back or one thought down. If you've got more than that, it's very difficult to play. But what I also try and do is make it automatic. So there's very few swing thoughts or just one, what I call one feel, might incorporate a swing thought or it might incorporate a movement. The feel can create the movement. So what you've got to do is practice in different modes to enable you to get on the golf course with a freer mind, not thinking too technically, but still have some technical kind of awareness. Because, you know, the ball responds to physics, doesn't respond to magic. So you can't just totally let go of it, go, okay, I've worked on my swing, I'm not going to think of anything. Well, you'll just go straight back to your old swing, right? So you've got to work on something or think about something. And, you know, some of the best players in the world can tell you what their swing thoughts were for whatever tournament it is, whatever round it is. Dick Fowler knows every single swing thought he ever had for any round he played. Jack Nicklaus said the most swing thoughts he can handle was 5. And people think he never thought of anything, but he did. So swing thoughts are part of it, but I like to term it a swing feel. So what do you do to reduce those so you don't get too technical? Well, first of all, you have a lesson that's not too technical. So don't get too far into the weeds. If you've got a coach giving you 25 things, it's not right. You know, narrow it down or pare it down to one or two little things. And then the second thing is how you practice. So how do you, so what you're trying to do is change a movement pattern. When you change that movement pattern, you're trying to master that movement pattern. The next phase would be to transfer that skill into the arena. Okay, how do you do that? Well, you do that by changing how you practice. So if you're on the range, you might have 20 minutes working, you know, consciously and technically on a little move. Let's say it's an over the top move. So you might be thinking, okay, left hip shifts, left arm goes across my chest. That might be your thought. Okay, I'm going to hit 20 slow motion, 3/4 swings, film a couple, bang. Okay, now after 20 minutes, you might go, right, now I'm going to switch modes and I'm going to try and incorporate that into a feel and get a little bit more external rather than internal. So you might stand there and go, okay, now I'm going to start this over that right flag, bring it back to the left flag. Anything that starts left, I know is steep. Anything that starts right with a draw, I know is shallow. I might just keep the feel of my left hip going, but I might consciously try and make the ball start right of that flag and go around it to the left. So then you start hitting shots like that with some flow and some feel and some external focus and some artistry. Still trying to kind of keep hold of your little technical feel. And again, trying to pare it down, trying to flow, trying to get ready to get in the arena. And then you do that with your routine. Then you do that with different clubs. And then you go and play golf. and then you come back and you repeat the cycle again. And then eventually your technical changes become normal, instinctive, and you end up on what I call automatic, which is where you're trying to get to.
You mentioned a minute ago that you've worked with Nelly Korda. She's had one of the great seasons in LPGA Tour history. Talk about getting to spend some time with her.
Yeah, I didn't work with her this season, actually. I worked with her in 2021. I think she got we had a part in the race for various reasons. When I worked with her, she won the Olympic gold medal. She won a major. She went to number one in the world, stuff like that. And she's obviously an amazing person, amazing family. What a family. What a sporting family. That, you know, Sebi's just playing in the US Open tennis. Jesse's obviously an incredible player, just had a baby at the moment. Nelly's amazing. The mother and father are both top tennis players in the world. I mean, there's probably no better sporting family in the world than those guys, I don't think. So amazing family to deal with. And I'm not sure who she's working with right now, but they're doing a great job. And, you know, she's keeping things in check. I mean, she lost a game for a little bit of period of time there after, you know, we kind of parted company a little bit. And she started experimenting a little bit too much. And then she's kind of now got a little, what we had, a similar thing, a little blueprint, and kind of sticks to it, really. And that's what you've got to do. You've got to find your blueprint, find your most efficient swing, and just stick with it. And you can see some of the drills she does. Some of them are what we worked on a couple of years ago, and some of them are new. But, you know, that pushing the ball with the back of the club, we worked on that. You know, right arm, you know, with a water wing, we've worked on that. And she just tries to maintain that, really. And at times, you know, she can get out of whack. One of her bad things is she gets the club and the arms behind her going back. And then on the way down, her arms steepen and shoot out into a steep position coming down. So she has to stand the shaft up. I mean, when I first met her in 21, she didn't believe in TrackMan, weirdly. I said, oh, where's your TrackMan when I first met her? I've known her as a kid. I had her on my shoulders when she was 9 years old in Prague. So I've known the family for years. And I said, oh, where's your TrackMan? She said, oh, I don't believe in TrackMan. I said, what? You don't believe in TrackMan? Are you kidding? So I said, right, go and buy a TrackMan, and next week we'll work with it a little bit. So I gave her only two tiles on TrackMan, okay, path and face, a little bit of attack angle, and got her to work with those for a while. And that helped her in 21 big time. And then I also got the caddy to get her doing some of the sort of tests on it. And really got her yardages tuned in for each event. So I got him to research the events and say, okay, you know, the bulk of the shots we're hitting in here, second shot on that course is going to be 110 to 150. Okay, let's work on those on a combine on TrackMan. Next tournament, okay, the most are going to be 120 to 180. Okay, let's work on those on a TrackMan combine. So that kind of helped using technology in that way. So, yeah, it's interesting. All the different players have all got their different things. They've all got their things they're trying to keep their eye on with their swing. You know, Justin Rose and whoever it is, they've all got something. Rory, you know, gets it behind him, and, you know, then the club falls behind him coming down. You know, everyone's got something they're always trying to combat or keep on top of. And, you know, Nelly's no different. As I say, she at times she can swing great, and then at times she can swing poorly and play poorly. So it's a fickle old game, that is for sure. But, yeah, it was a great privilege to be involved with them. And, I really enjoyed my time with them.
Another major champion that you've spent some time with is Michael Campbell, who won the 2005 U.S. Open. He's a guy who doesn't seem to get the amount of credit or respect that I think he's earned, not only for winning a U.S. Open, but also winning seven more times on the European Tour, seven times on the Australia-Asian Tour. It's not like he was a one-hit wonder, but it's like people don't want to give him the credit. I don't understand it.
No, I don't get that either. It's crazy. I mean, as you say, he won 15 times around the world. I mean, that's quite a stellar career. I mean, he made quite a few dollars out of the game, but also an incredible player. I mean, Tiger in his prime had an aura and a presence that no one could beat him. I remember being on the range and Ernie Els was there, and Ernie Els was a great player at that time, a dominant player. He said, I remember being on the range, point blank saying, we can't beat this guy. And, you know, there was a presence to him and no one could beat him. And yet Michael beat him twice in his prime. You know, Michael shot 62-63 back-to-back in Germany once. You know, he's a quality player. To face Tiger down in a US Open, you know, and come through like he did, you know, hitting a couple of clutch shots under the gun and having a three-shot lead down the last. You can't fluke that. You can't fluke a major. Just being anywhere in the mix on the last day, you played well. And so, you know, you can't fluke a major. But I think, you know, what's been to his detriment there's a school of players who win a major and kick on and, you know, do amazing things, probably win one or two more, like Harrington and those guys. Obviously Tiger and all the superstars. But and there's also a little category of players who win a major and that's it. They can't handle it. Ian Baker Finch, David DeVal, Michael's a little bit in that category. You know, they kind of can't handle what comes with it. No one warns you about what comes with it. You know, Hamilton, you know, all those type of players. There's a lot that comes with it. And then you start playing with expectation rather than flow and feel and flair. And, you know, then all of a sudden the game gets difficult. So, he, you know, it's a little bit of his demise, really, after he won that. And I think, you know, that's probably the bit that people look at. Whereas people who really know and have known his career and known how he played in Europe for such a long time, particularly in Australia, realised what a quality player he was. I mean, he was he's definitely the best iron ball striker I've ever worked with, and probably at one stage in the top three in the world with an iron. His nemesis was always his driver a little bit, because what made him a great iron player was he hit down at it so solidly and such an aggressive attack angle, and, you know, really crushed it out there, flew it out there. But what made him so good with that club didn't make him so good with a driver. He used to hit down on that a little bit. And as the bigger-headed modern drivers came out, he didn't get the benefit of it as a lot of other players did. So a bit like Nick Price and those type of players. So, yeah, it's interesting. But, yeah, I find it incredibly annoying. I remember a Golf Digest guy came out and point blank said he's the worst player to win a major. I'm like, are you absolutely kidding me? Have you seen his track record? I actually contacted him personally because I was so annoyed with that comment, because it was so unfair, number one. I mean, the guy's won 15 times around the world. He shot 24 under par in big events. He was a class player and a very well-respected player. And, you know, to say that was so disrespectful to what he achieved. And, you know, he's just a, you know, all-round great guy, Michael. So he definitely deserves more credit than he got for that. That is for sure.
What are some things that you saw him go through? You mentioned people don't tell you what goes along with winning a major. What were some of the things that he had to deal with that they don't warn you about? It's not in the pamphlet that when you hold a U.S. Open or whatever the major championship is, you got to get prepared for these things. What are they?
Oh, you just get so many opportunities and so much demands on your time all of a sudden. So you've got to do the Letterman show. They want you to be here. They want you to be there. They want you to fly here. They want you to fly there. They want you to appear in this thing, that thing. You know, before you know it, your agent's coming up to you with 55 things on the table, and you're like, what? You know, I'm used to just doing A, B, and C, and all of a sudden you've got 55 other things. So all those things get pulled in, and then you go to tournaments, and you've got bigger crowds than you had before. You've got bigger crowds in the practice round than you had before. You've got, you know, the expectations then become greater for you. Obviously, as a golf coach, especially a high level one, part of your job is trying to manage that and trying to get the player to understand that, listen, it's their expectations, not yours. For us, it's the same thing. It's a process. There's 18 tees, 18 flags, and we're just going through the process of trying to improve. But it's very hard to not let that permeate your brain a little bit on some level, where you're thinking, oh geez, everyone's watching me. You know, the media's watching me more. So you go out a practice round. Before, you'd have a quiet practice round on your own or with someone else, no one around. All of a sudden, you go out as a fresh major winner. You've got 40 cameras around you. You've got a crowd of 10,000 people. You know, so all those things change, and you can't get away from things. You can't go out for a quiet meal at a restaurant. You've got to sign 43 autographs and take 27 pictures. And listen, they're not complaining about it. He said, obviously, you've done something great if that's happening. But that no one prepares you for that. No one prepares you. Like, Michael was a below the radar, liked the anonymity, liked going about his business and no one recognizing him. All of a sudden, everywhere he went, someone recognized him. And it's hard to deal with for some people, especially with his personality. He's a very shy guy. He's a very quiet guy. So some people can deal with it. Gregarious people, you know, they love it. John Daly, those type of people, they love it. Other people are on the other side of it. They're like, I was quite happy just kind of, you know, muddling along and going through my normal routine and stuff like that. But now I can't, because, you know, I've got to do a press conference there. I've got to do this over there. That magazine wants this. And so you have to start saying no to a lot of stuff so it doesn't affect your game so much. But initially, it's hard to do that. So there's a lot of things that you don't see as a layman just watching it that happen to these guys when they win a major and they win big tournaments. And that's why I've got massive respect. Whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, whether they shoot good numbers or bad numbers, I respect any person who's in the arena, because there's a lot more to it than you guys think.
Jonathan, just a couple more before I let you go. And one of those things that he was asked to do, you've got a picture with Michael ringing the bell on the New York Stock Exchange. What was that like?
That's an off-course career highlight for me and for him, actually. I think we enjoyed it. Chris DeMarco at the time, going back a bit now. Chris DeMarco was sponsored by the New York Stock Exchange, so he was involved as well. The US Open after the one Michael won in 2005 was in Bethpage Black, so it was in the city. And you're amazing. What you get is that you get a little tour of the whole stock exchange before it opens. There's some massive halls in there that people don't know about, like enormous banquet halls and stuff with really high ceilings. There's a lot of obviously history. They give you a guided tour. Then you get on the floor, and it's a bit different now, obviously, with all the computers and stuff. But at that time, it was all traders, you kind of stand on the balcony and wait for them to turn up, and they start turning up like little bees around a beehive. And then all hell breaks loose, and you ring that bell, and it was a amazing experience. I didn't have a tie or anything that week, and you have to have a tie and a collar and a tie, because I was just going to the tournament. I didn't realize I was doing that, and I had to borrow the collar and tie from the main guy that runs the place. And it's just interesting. The whole thing is fascinating, actually, a different world altogether. And the irony is, I now work up in New York for half the year, and so I teach a lot of guys in the city who do the financial side of the world. And so I kind of mix and rub shoulders with those guys. It's amazing how their business has changed. It's so computerized nowadays, and it's all algorithms and black boxes and all sorts of stuff on the stock exchange nowadays. So it's very interesting chatting to them and seeing how, just like golf, just like everything in life, it's changed from the 05 era in golf has changed to the 2024 era, just like the stock exchange has. So yeah, but it was a really amazing experience. I'm from a normal background. I'm a normal guy. I would never have thought in a million years I'd be part of the party that opens the New York Stock Exchange. So, yeah, definitely a career highlight. Yeah, they give you a little medal at the end and a little name badge, which I've framed and put in my house, and I walk past it most days. So it's a very proud moment for me, that is for sure.
Jonathan, I want to get a quick playing lesson from you. About a year ago, you put out a video about how many of the best putters in the game start out by putting their lead hand on their lead leg. In the case of a right-handed player, obviously that's a left hand on the left leg. And then they aim the putter with their right hand. Talk about that and walk us through how that is going to help us make more putts.
If you watch that, I put that out there. It's had almost a million views, I think. Because that's a thing that a lot of really good putters do. They put their left hand on their lead leg, and they hold the putter in the right hand only, and they aim the putter first. So they aim the face, they get the shaft at 90 degrees if you look from the front. They get the putter sitting how it's made to sit. Scotty Cameron putters have got a loft of 2.5 degrees. So if that shaft's at 90 degrees when you look from the front, that has got 2.5 degrees of loft. If that face is pointing where you think it's pointing, it's like aiming a gun. Then you set up around that square club. You're confident that you're set up around a square club. If you go in with it, holding it in two hands, and you kind of just randomly have a practice swing and put it behind the ball, you don't know how square it is. There's lots of variables in that. Part of your routine is getting your posture, holding your right hand only, position the face like the sights of a gun, get the shaft at 90, get the face exactly where you want it to go, and then introduce your left hand. Now, all of a sudden, you've got more confidence in the fact you know where it's aiming, and you're more tuned into where it's aiming. And that becomes part of your routine. So you make a better stroke. You've got more confidence in your stroke. And it just takes a couple of variables out. And it's amazing how many, if you really look at it, how many players actually do that. A lot more than you think, just for those reasons. It just helps reduce a couple of variables and improve your routine. So you want to make more putts without changing your stroke, incorporate that. You go to my Twitter and have a look. It's pinned on the first page of my Twitter. It's a really, really common thing that people do, and what people don't really notice that people do, but it's going to help your game for sure.
Jonathan, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can they stay up to all the great things you're doing, whether it's on your website or it's on social media?
Yeah, you just social media. I do tons of stuff on that, as you've alluded to. So it's at Jonathan Yarwood, Jonathan Yarwood, Yarwood. And all my stuff's on there, all the links to online lessons, and just loads of daily tips, really. If you have a lesson, it's great. If you don't, that's also great. And just put topical stuff on there that might interest people and also help their game. So Just if you're on Twitter, just don't give me a load of abuse and a load of hassle. Instagram crowd are very calm. The Twitter crowd are a little bit. Probably have a few more drinks, or a bit more middle aged. I don't know, but they're a bit louder.
Indeed, Jonathan. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of the show. You're one of the all time greats, my friend. I can't thank you enough.
I appreciate, Chris, and really great to see your podcast voted so highly all the time. And you know, you do a great job, and I listen to it regularly and get some a lot better guests than me on it. I'm grateful to be part of it, and congratulations on your success.
I appreciate that very much, my friend. Take care. All the best to you and your family. Look forward to catching up again soon.
Appreciate it, man. Have a
good
day.
See you, Jonathan.
See ya. Bye.
That is the great Jonathan Yarwood. And again, at Jonathan Yarwood, YARWOOD is the spelling of his last name. It's fantastic stuff out there on Twitter or X or whatever we're calling that thing these days, and also on Instagram. Like I say, he is a guy who has so much knowledge and is willing to share it with us all the time. This is a guy that could be charging hundreds of dollars for free for lessons for you to go on, whether it's V1 or whatever the app you want of your choice. If you're going to go out there and you're going to look for a great coach, he's going to be someone you're going to pick. But he chooses to put that stuff out there on social media for us to go out there and consume for free. And that's one of the things I love about him. He's as you learn through the course of this conversation and when he's been on previously, he's just a great guy to begin with. He's very humble. And then to be able to give back, that's what he said. He does it because he wants to give back to the game. And that's what makes him special. And I can't thank him enough. I know he's very, very busy and doing some great things down there with junior players in Orlando this week, but he's always a very sought after and a busy guy. And I can't thank him enough for taking a few minutes to come and be a part of the show again this week. Hopefully we get to catch up with him again a little bit later on in the year. Okay, coming up next in segment two is going to be Tom Pertzer. Before I bring Tom into the show, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year. And I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player... I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe. And I need all the help I can get. And the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I also want to give a shout out to my friends over at On Point Golf and their great On Point ball marker. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with On Point, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf, and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023, and they were using an on-point ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use On Point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Now back in Next on the Tee with me is PGA Tour legend Tom Pertzer. As you guys know, Tom is absolutely one of my all-time favorite people on the planet, let alone guests on the show. He has come to mean a lot to me over the last several years. He's been fantastic every single time he's joined me, plus a wonderful supporter of the show, which I can't thank him enough for. Let me remind you a little bit about his background. He's from Des Moines, Iowa, played his college golf at Arizona State from 1970 to 73, turned pro a little bit later on in the year in 73, got his first tour victory at the 1977 Glen Campbell Los Angeles Open, defeating Lanny Watkins by a stroke. Tom went 5 times on the PGA Tour, 4 more times out on the Champions Tour. In all, he has 15 professional wins. He's always been known for having one of the all-time great swings out on tour, and it's always a huge thrill for me to have him with me here on the show. Hey, Tom, how are you, my friend?
Great to hear from you. I'm glad to, always glad to be on your show. You're the best.
Tom, you were letting me know a little bit earlier today. You're actually out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. A lot of beautiful golf courses out in that part of the country. What's got you in Jackson Hole?
There are. I've got a really good friend in Phoenix that tells me every time I see him how cool Jackson Hole is. So I just did a school with my brother in Steamboat Springs. So we did that. And then I said, man, I'm just going to drive up to Jackson Hole. I've got some friends up here. So I'm spending some time with them. Beautiful house and great scenery. Man, it's so beautiful up here. Haven't played any golf, but I may get in a round or two.
Well, I hope you do. It'd be a shame to get all the way up there with those courses and not at least get out once. So hopefully you get to put a peg in the ground before too long.
Yes, sir.
Tom, I want to get your thoughts. The PGA Tour season is over now. We're on the heels of the Tour Championship. I want to get your thoughts about the Tour having a playoff system and then what you saw over this past week.
Well, I love the playoff system. My only thing is, to the year that Scotty had, it seems like he should have got more than a two shot advantage. Xander was, a little 1,000 points behind him. And then the next Hideki was, 3,600 points or something. And then Colin was 4,000 points behind him. So it just seems like he should have got a bigger advantage. And I know that only two of the last 5 years, the guy leading coming into that tournament has won the FedEx Cup. So I think there's a little bit of a flaw to, if Scotty wouldn't have won and had the year he had and not got the FedEx Cup, I think it wouldn't have been right. I don't know. That's just my opinion. And then I see on Facebook and stuff that Scotty didn't win the Tour Championship. Well, nobody's going to tell me that if Scotty's name was not on the top of the leaderboard, that it would have been. I don't care, points or no point, two-stroke advantage or no two-stroke advantage. If somebody would have been coming at him, I guarantee you he would have figured out a way to be on top, strokes or no strokes.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I feel like they've got to do something different because, to your point, the year that Scotty had to start out with a two-stroke lead in that staggered leaderboard, and that two-stroke lead was gone on the first hole. He makes bogeys in or makes birdie. Now we're all square. It doesn't feel like for the year and the amount of points lead that he had going in that was right. Now, I don't know what the right thing to do is, but that seems like it's got to get overhauled because, to your point, if he had lost, if Colin had come all the way through and he wins the Tour Championship and the FedEx Cup, I mean, he didn't have near the year that Scotty had. He didn't even win this year. And Scotty won 6 times plus the Olympic gold medal and all of that. So it just would have been crazy to me that anybody else could have been holding that cup, but it was sure a possibility that it could have happened.
Yeah, it is. And everything you said is on right on point. And, it would have been a shame if Scotty wouldn't have won, but it just shows you Scotty's character. I mean, he shanks a ball out of a bunker on the backside, and that didn't fluster him. I think after that hole, he only had like a two stroke advantage or something, and he came through, and man, he made a couple birdies, made an eagle. He's an extraordinary player. He's a little bit Tiger-ish.
Yeah. So let's take that a step further, because when Tiger had seasons like Scotty did. I mean, it was all the rage. I mean, it's the only thing you ever heard of. And I think Scotty is flying a little bit under the radar. I mean, he just had the lowest scoring average in history this season, even better than Tiger's season in 2000. But you wouldn't know it if you did know it. It doesn't feel to me like the PGA Tour is doing enough, not only to promote how great Scotty has played the last two seasons, but also Xander's, you know, year. He won two majors, something that hasn't been done since Brooks did it back in 2018. And it's only happened twice since 2007. But even here in Atlanta, Tom, no billboards for the Tour Championship with Scotty or Xander's picture on them, advertising that the Tour Championship was in town, advertising what great players they are. PGA Tour radio still plays sound bites from when Tiger won the 2019 Masters. It doesn't feel like the Tour knows what to do for Scotty. And I would think for how great he has played over the last two seasons, particularly this year, his face should be plastered everywhere.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I could improve on what you just said, but, you know, Tiger has been, you know, he's iconic. He's world renowned. You know, everybody, when you see a picture of Tiger, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, people knows who it is. So, but yeah, I mean, I agree. They don't do a good enough job. You know what? Oh, it's been too easy for them in the past, I don't know what, 20 years. It's been too easy for the Tour to promote Tiger. And I think it's unfair, you know, to the young guys that are coming on and coming on strong. I mean, we've got, you know, the best group of young players that I can ever remember. You know, you got Scotty, Xander, Berg, you know, just Colin, Rory. I mean, all those guys, they've got a grit, and they're all seem to be really good guys. That's the thing that I think is so fun to see. You know, they're all rooting each other on. They all, you know, they wait for the guy. If one of their buddies is winning, they wait till on the 18th hole to congratulate him and stuff. And I think that's so cool. I don't remember when I was playing, I don't remember that happening. But, you know, to your point, I think they need to do a better job. They need to get out of their little box and promote these young kids. And it's going to keep happening. I mean, there's going to be more and more of these young players coming right out of college that are going to go, you know, that are going to go crazy and be superstars. So, you know, to not acknowledge Scotty's year and Xander's year with not being on billboards and not being on TV promotions that the Tour does is, I don't know, it just seems like it's something's not quite right.
Tom, I want to switch gears and go back into your playing career. And like I mentioned in your intro, you turned pro in 1973, got your first win in 77, you win again in 84, and then really had great seasons late in the 80s and early part of the 90s, get two wins in 91. And those two wins in 91 gave you a 10-year exemption on tour, essentially allowing you to play right up to the time when you would transition over to the Champions Tour. Did that 10-year exemption, did that take a lot of pressure off you and allow you to kind of free up and just go out and play?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and who knew that, you know, I had my best year in 1991, and then first week of 1992, I got hurt. So I was, and I don't think my, you know, my swing changed a bit. I wasn't able to turn as well going back. So, you know, and if I wouldn't have won there, I would have been out of a job probably in the next couple of years after that. But yeah, it worked out great for me. You know, it was God's gift that that I was able to get that 10-year, because it, like you said, it took me right on to the Champions Tour and took a ton of pressure off. You know, I was in, you know, all the tournaments from year 91 to 2001. So it was huge.
One of the things that Gary Player and I have talked about over the years is one of the most important measurements of greatness is longevity. And you certainly had that How were you able to sustain your level of play for 40 plus years between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour?
To me, that was the key to my career, I think, is being able to play at a high level for quite a few years. And, you know, I think some of it is the swing that I had. I felt confident with my swing. Wouldn't have traded my swing with anybody else. So I would have traded my short game, my putting, with a lot of players. But I still had enough good weeks of putting that I was able to win some events and come close in a couple majors. So that's always fun. But to me, you know, if you can continue to play at a high level for a number of years means a lot. And, there's been quite a few guys that have done that. But I'm just fortunate that I was one of them.
Tom, over the span of my lifetime, in my opinion, Dean Beaman has been the best commissioner of the PGA Tour. I don't believe the pro game would be fractured like it is today if Dean Beaman was still the commissioner. Am I wrong about that?
No, you are 100% right. He was by far the best commissioner that I've been around. Dean was a player and a very intelligent human being. And he didn't take any crap from anybody. He would listen to, you know, to the Jack and Arnold, and he got, you know, ideas and stuff from them. But he was a visionary. TPC and Sawgrass, that was his baby. And, to me, the tour would not be in this situation if Dean was still commissioner. He would have figured something out to not have this fractured professional golf that we have right now. It's a shame. It's a shame that it's become what it has.
Tom, just a couple more before I let you go. And you played in a lot of two-person team events. You played in the Chrysler Team Championship with Jim Colbert, the Fred Meyer Challenge with Steve Elkington, the Shark Shootout with Lanny Watkins, the JCPenney Classic with Julie Inkster. Did you enjoy getting into those kind of events? Those were always sort of after the season was over, a little bit later on in the year. But did you like getting into those kind of team events?
I loved them. You know, it actually is more pressure than just playing on your own. But I had great partners. I had Julie Inkster, and we won the JCPenney's mixed team tournament. And then Lanny, playing with Lanny in the Shark Shootout. And, you know, I didn't have to think a bit because Lanny he directed me around the whole 54 holes. But that was probably my most fun event with Lanny because you're playing three different, games in that deal. And then Elk, it's awesome watching his golf swing. So we had fun there and in Peter's tournament. And then Jim and I should have won the Chrysler team. We needed to make a birdie on 17, and I three putted on a par five, so we kind of messed up there. And then we're in the playoff, and we both had chances, and we both missed putts. So, you know, just for me, the team tournaments were just so much fun. You got to joke around with your partner and mess around with other teams. So, I truly enjoyed each one of those tournaments that I won.
Along with your tour victories, you won the 1981 Gerald Ford Invitational, which was a pro-am held out in Vail, Colorado. You beat John Cook, Craig Stadler, and Curtis Strange by a stroke. What was it like playing in a pro-am event hosted by President Ford?
Well, it was pretty much an honor being invited to play in it. I had played with him, with the president, a few years earlier at the Los Angeles Open tournament the year after I won. he came out and he played in the Pro-Am, and that was so much fun. He was such a nice man. It was pretty special winning his event, you know, and it came at a great time because it was in the middle of summer and, you know, we're playing in Memphis and Williamsburg, hottest place in the world, and get to go to Vail, Colorado, and spend a few days there. And, you know, it was a great, great little event and, you know, pretty good competition. There were a lot of good players that played there. And, you know, and it was for fun, but when everybody got on the golf course, it became a tournament.
Tom, before I let you go, you mentioned you've been doing some things with your brother. He's got a wonderful academy that you are a part of at different times during the year. Talk about all the great things you're doing now and how we can stay up to date with you.
Yeah, it's been fun. He's a director of instruction at Catamount Golf Club in Steamboat Springs. So I went up there, and you know, anytime I get a chance to leave hot Phoenix in the summertime, I'm in. So he asked me to come up, and we did a nice little 3-day deal for the members there, and had a blast. And we had a friend of mine, Jack Stradlin, that came up and helped us. He was a tour player, and you know, I've known him forever. So there were three of us. We had a good time, and you know, now I'm still doing a little bit of teaching with him, but my main focus is turning into, I got my real estate license about not quite a year ago. So I've been hooked up with a really good guy in Phoenix, in Scottsdale. And we're kind of picking out really good golf course properties in the North Scottsdale area to list and then to sell. So it's been fun. It's like starting a new career at my age, and it's been interesting. And you know, hopefully things will turn around with the economy and with the interest rates and stuff, and it'll be fun again.
Well, Tom, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to come back and be a part of the show. You're very special to me, and I can't thank you enough for everything that you've meant to me over the years, you've meant to the show over the years, and you've meant to all of us in the golfing world for the last 40, 50 years that you've been a part of it, because you've changed the game and made it better for all of us on so many levels, whether we're watching you, watching your golf swing, or getting a lesson from you. Everything that you have touched has been fantastic, and including this show. I can't thank you enough.
Well, thanks, Chris. You know, like everybody that's on your show says, you're the best. You are the best. You're the most prepared podcast. It's easy to see why you have the number one podcast in golf, and it all stems around you. You're great. You make us sound good, and I can't tell you how happy it is when you call and ask me to be on your show. It means a lot.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. Enjoy Jackson Hole. I hope we get the privilege of having you back on the show again soon.
Okay, Chris. Anytime.
See you, Tom.
Okay, thanks.
That is the great Tom Pertzer. And again, look, if you're in the Phoenix, Scottsdale area and you want a great realtor, you need to be calling Tom Pertzer. I mean, how great would it be to have him as the guy that is out there looking for a property for you or selling yours? They don't come better than this guy. And take the golf off the table. He's just one of the great people you're going to meet in this life. So getting to spend some time with him and have him as your representative, boy, I can't imagine anything better than that. And look, he had one of the greatest swings of all time. Anybody will tell you, when they say who had the sweetest swing of all time, they may name a couple of guys, but in that couple of guys is going to be Tom Pertzer. So look, he's doing a little bit of coaching still. So look, you want to get a great coach, reach out to Tom Pertzer. And then the real estate piece is another thing. But then just as, to me, as a wonderful human being, they just don't come better than him. He has just been so wonderful to me and been such a great guest and shared so many great stories and things that he has been a part of over the course of the time he's been on this show. I can't thank him enough. A wonderful guy. We'll get him back on hopefully again before this year is out. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on part one of this week's episode. My sincere thanks to Jonathan Yarwood and Tom Pertzer for making it so much fun for me to be a part of. I hope you all enjoyed it as well. Please come back for part two featuring our monthly visit from the confidence doctor, Dr. Bob Winters, and the head golf professional at the Pittsburgh Field Club, Chris Sheehan. Folks, I can't thank you enough for making Next on the Tee a part of your regular golf content. Shout out to my friends over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for hosting this show on their site. You can find it by going to triblive.com. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, hit him straight, my friends.
Coming down the mountain, I take a breath of sin. Can't tell the day or time, but I know this day will end. On a mission I can't see, they say I am the one. In the end, it's you and me as we ride into the sun. So we ride another big thumb down the drag. We ride another day from the insane.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.